KLOS and KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. This is the Rock of Southern California. Now, shining a light on the people, organizations, and events that bring Southern Californians together. This is Spotlight on the Community with your host, Doug McIntyre.
I was on a plane over the weekend. Leanne was on a plane, I think, this morning. Coming back from Kentucky just a few hours ago.
Pretty much. I think I got home by midnight.
And if anybody's been to the airport of late, you know that the airports are packed. Just about all the airports. U.S. Airlines expect to carry 234 million passengers from June 1st through August 31st, which is an enormous number of people. It's up from the summer record of 225 million a year ago. So obviously that's an indication that both the economy has recovered and they found the right ticket price point for people to get on airplanes.
Unless someone's just looking for a payday like David Dow.
But meanwhile, a lot of folks are experiencing difficulties in the air, especially if you've been trying to fly out of Heathrow on British Airlines.
Oh,
75,000 passengers over the holiday weekend because of a computer system malfunction. So we've got that to talk about. Plus, and this could be a huge change, the Department of Homeland Security is considering banning carry-on laptops on all foreign flights. So it would be iPads and your laptops, which would be a real serious blow to productivity for business travelers. So with all these issues on the table and more, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show to talk about him, aviation expert and author of the New York Times best-selling books, including Lockout. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show, John Nance. John, how are you?
Good to be with you again.
So 234 million people, obviously, enormous throngs of people cramming onto planes. And as Leanne was just saying, nobody seems to be in a great mood these days on their flight.
There are exceptions. With the larger airlines, of course, there's not. And some of the larger airlines, and with the ones that have been merged in the past couple of years and the mergers haven't gone well, they're especially upset, which means lousy customer service and very poor decision-making when it comes to a conflict with any passenger. And that's what you saw, of course, with United Airlines and that doctor being dragged off the airplane, literally. But the thing is, in addition to the crowding, the one thing that we have going for us has been a heightened concern for air safety that wasn't there really to this extent 20 years ago. But you mentioned the possibility of the banning of laptops. This is a concern of throwing people from the frying pan into the fire in terms of putting laptops down in the hold and creating even more of a hazard than the perceived hazard from terrorists.
Well, and it's interesting because I believe it was American Airlines, one of the major carriers, just announced that they were going to do away with the screens built into the back of the seats because they said so many people were flying with digital devices that they didn't need to have them anymore. And now, just as they're making that decision, we're starting to see the DHS may ban people carrying their digital devices aboard.
There are a couple of points here. Number one, I am still, quite frankly, highly suspicious of the motivation for this ban from airlines coming into the United States from the Middle East and from Islamic countries, because I think it may have been a backdoor. There's some indications it may have been a backdoor method for this so-called administration to push its agenda that couldn't get through the courts on an immigration ban. Now, that could be entirely incorrect. But a lot of aviation people are very, very suspicious of this ban. Is there a possibility that the terrorists have, in fact, figured out ways to put explosive devices in computers? Yes, of course. And that is a serious concern. But again, if you put millions, literally millions of lithium ion batteries in luggage, in cargo holds, that is a very, very potentially lethal combination because you don't have the opportunity to know that something is smoldering. And if it's an explosive down there, it may do just as much damage, if not more, as one that managed to get into the cabin.
We're talking about John Nance, of course, a best-selling author, aviation expert. John, flying back from Kennedy Airport to LAX on Sunday, I was asked a question by the TSA agents that I've never been asked before. He asked, do you have any candy or food in your carry-on? And if so, you have to put it in the tray.
What?
I'd never heard that before.
I've never been asked that either.
quite frankly, I haven't either. That's a new one on me. TSA is constantly testing particular things in regard to response to not just perceived threats, but to what intelligence provides as new threats, and maybe it's a box of candy is now something that they have targeted. I don't know. I never heard of that before. I'm used to TSA changing their procedures as a result of a direct threat, but I think in terms of this laptop ban, again, you've got to consider A, the source, B, the degree to which we can trust Secretary Kelly, and he's a new one on the block coming from an administration that is highly questionable in terms of their intent, and three, you know, the myopia, again, on the cargo hold versus the cabin. Now, again, if it really is a valid threat and they know more about this than they did before, and they don't think that they can put anything in place that's going to be able to ferret out such a device before it gets on the airplane, i.e. in a laptop or an iPad, then, of course, we need to take action.
Well, it was my understanding that in Europe they've already banned the laptops on flights because of concerns. Because of concerns about the batteries.
Yeah, well, they have not done this on domestic flights in Europe yet. British Air and the British government banned anything coming from the Middle East or from Islamic countries into London as something that they did in lockstep with the United States. So, again, you can't dismiss this. It may be as serious a threat as TSA is saying or as Homeland Security is saying, but, again, the earmarks are not necessarily pristine.
Now, John, this is my own theory on part of the irritation of modern flight. I'm not like one of those once-a-week flyers, but I probably fly 10 times, maybe a dozen times a year. And the disintegration of the flight experience to me coincided when the airlines started charging for checked luggage. And
yes.
Now everybody wants to carry every single thing they own onto the plane, and it's turned the boarding process into a rugby scrub.
Including the kitchen sink.
Because they know that the last people on the plane are not going to have, there's not going to be any room left for their carry-on bags. And then they're stuck having to wait down at the baggage carousel. And I swear, if the airlines would just simply raise the ticket prices $25 a person and build it into the price of ticket and let people check luggage like they used to, I think it would take an awful lot of the stress out of the boarding and flight experience.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And you take a look at our friends at Southwest Airlines. They figured this out before they made that mistake, and they've reaped quite a benefit for having no baggage fees. And there are other airlines, like Alaska Airlines, for instance, that extends and I'm parochial there because, of course, I'm a retired Alaska captain. But I think we've done a lot of things in the industry that are nickel and diming the public to death and are creating an unintended consequence, exactly as you pointed out. The last person on the airplane has no hope of getting much on the overhead. This is where the lack of oversight, you know, there is a role for government. I don't care what your political philosophy is. There is a rationale for governmental control in some areas. You don't want it to go too far, but you also don't want it to be completely absent because if it's the law of the jungle out there, then we get a predictable result. And that's essentially where we've gone, permitting the airlines to nickel and dime their passengers to death. But a crime to get them to change course on this is murder, because they're making incredible amounts of money off the backs of passengers who have to roll their eyes and say, well, I got to carry my bag one way or another, so I guess I better pay the $25.
Can I just tell you a funny story? You know, my husband was a pilot at JetBlue in his early career, and now he's at United. But he said when they were doing one of their flights back from like Puerto Rico or one of the South American countries, that literally somebody came on and came on with their luggage. It was a kitchen sink. It was a sink that just had like twine wrapped around it, and they were trying to put it in the overhead bins. No joke.
Well, it doesn't surprise me.
I mean, it was.
I wish I had a picture of that.
Yes, he's like, you see the most incredible things. They literally were carrying back a kitchen sink. Carry on.
Well, I flew in South America for a carrier that some people still remember, Braniff International, many years ago.
Yeah, sure. Actually, great food on Braniff.
Yeah, we would leave at Lima, Peru at 1 or 2 in the morning and come back to the States. And I swear people were bringing their grandmothers and friends in their hang-up bags. It was amazing the things that were dragged onto the cabin.
When you see a chicken as carry-on luggage. We're talking with John Nance, whose best-selling books include, of course, Lockout and many others, both fiction and nonfiction. They're all great reads. On Shaky Ground, by the way, one of the best books on earthquakes I've ever read. But don't read it too close to an earthquake because you'll never sleep again. It'll scare you so much. Now, what happened from your perspective? What happened to British Airways? What went wrong at Heathrow?
You know, British Airways is one of the most trusted and reasonably so airlines in the world, but they have obviously not been paying attention to contingency planning. To have a backup system fail because it has the same components, including battery power, as the primary system is simply not acceptable in this day and age. We know better than that. We've known better than that for a long time. So the, one of the things, of course, they've got to do is parse through this. It's never just one cause to a major incident. And when they finally put it out on the table and figure out what went wrong, they're going to have to build defense systems that have a primary and a tertiary, possibly backup, that could take the entire airline operation in a nanosecond, transfer it over to another source, and keep the airline running. Because this day and time, everything, including the legality of your dispatching, is dependent on your computer system. And if it fails, as we saw, you're simply not an airline anymore.
Did I read somewhere that they had just switched over their online capacity to like India? They outsourced it. Is that true?
I don't know that for a fact.
Okay, I read that last night. Well,
yeah, I don't know that for a fact. But whatever they did, it was obviously grossly inadequate.
Obviously the volume of travel this summer at 234 million. By the way, this is just domestic travel. Okay, these are within the United States. Now there may be flights going overseas, but there's flights originating from the U.S. 234 million passengers from June 1st through August 31st. We have a major airport here in Los Angeles called Los Angeles International Airport. And one of the things that always strikes me when you fly away from here is how squished into such a tiny amount of land LAX is compared to, let's say, you know, take anyone. Obviously, Denver, they built the airport 40 miles out of the city. But even at JFK in New York, there's all kinds of elbow room to grow and expand the facilities. Where in LA, we put the airport in a part of the city that back when it was built originally was wide open, but the city encroached upon it, and there's not really much room to spread our wings here.
That's true. And matter of fact, the encroachment was almost instantaneous, as happens many places around the country. You remember the off the northern complex of runways on the western side, on the beach side, they had to buy up and eradicate a whole housing development to get some of the obstacles out of the way. This is way, way back. You can still see the residential streets over there on the western end of what we call 2-4 left and right. But unfortunately, this is part of our master planning problem with aviation nationwide. Aviation has grown far faster than governmental authorities, both local and national, have really expected, even though the figures were there many years ago to say, well, this is going to be one of our major forms of well, not just life, but our major methodology of getting back and forth. So what do we do at a point like this? You look at reliever airports, and of course, L.A. has a bunch of them. Long Beach is not getting utilized to the extent that maybe it could, but the problem is not being able to transfer passengers among those. There's no high-speed rail to get from, you know, John Wayne to Long Beach to LAX up to Burbank. And I think that lack of foresight going back many, many decades is hamstringing us. There's just so much capacity, and we're there. We're right at the limits.
John, as always, we always thank you for coming on. Your insights into this, appreciate it. John Nance, aviation expert, best-selling author, and he's one of the best in the biz. You know, when we talk about drugs, we've been talking a lot, obviously, about pot because of the legalization of pot in California and many other places, and also the opioid epidemic in America, which continues to take lives tragically. But if you are going to take illicit drugs, which one is the safest one to take? To talk to us about that, this is pretty interesting. Addiction psychologist and founder of the Global Drug Survey. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. Adam Winstock. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
And the survey says that it's actually what is known on the street or in the vernacular as magic mushrooms.
Shrooms!
Why is that?
Yes. So the question that we asked, and we asked 120,000 people from around the world what drugs they'd used and what they kind of their experiences, good and bad. And one of the questions we asked for everyone who had used a drug in the last year we said, how do you have to end up seeking emergency medical treatment? Did you have to end up in the ER room? And the drug that was least likely to land you in the ER room was magic mushrooms. So that was 0.2% of over 10,000 people who've taken mushrooms in the last year. Now, that compares to 1% of LSD users, about 1% of cocaine users, 1% of MDMA users. So considerably less. But, of course, people don't take shrooms that often. And the most important thing is when people take shrooms, they plan their trip. And that's really important.
You know, this is a drug that I really don't know much about. They've been around as long as I've been around, obviously.
I've got some experience.
But now, essentially, the high from mushrooms, from using magic mushrooms, was created synthetically with LSD, except obviously the natural product doesn't have the same deleterious health effects as long-term use of the pharmaceutical.
There'd probably be a lot of people who would argue that even long-term use of LSD isn't that deleterious in terms of people don't become addicted, people don't overdose. In fact, people don't tend to become addicted to either LSD or magic mushrooms because most people do them, you know, 5, 10, 15 times in their life. So they're not really drugs that lend them to abuse. I think magic mushrooms are perhaps easier to dose. You know, when someone sells you a tab of acid, you don't know if it's got, you know, something that's going to make the walls look a bit brighter or something that's going to make you walk through the walls and kind of see pink butterflies before your head. So it can be a little bit tricky to dose with LSD.
I'm just curious. You know, I've never done drugs in my life, actually. But you've said with mushrooms, sometimes that people plan their trips. What do you mean by that? Do you just mean like they have a drug and they take it at a certain time and in a place where they're comfortable with their surroundings? Or is that what you mean?
Absolutely. So people who take psychedelics are generally aware of the fact that these drugs can have significant effects on the way you see the world, how you think, how you feel. And so people take great care to make sure they're with people they trust, that they're in a safe location, that they don't have to drive home.
It's really important.
Absolutely, doctor. Yeah, that's the sort of stuff.
If you're in an unfamiliar place and you're with people you don't know, you freak out and then you're scared. But if you're comfortable and you're around good people and you do what I did when I did it, which is I go to a movie theater and then I go play laser tag, it's one of the best experiences you can ever have. But I would also say one of the reasons I would say mushrooms isn't addictive is you can't even use it again right away. One time I had the best trip ever. I wanted to do it the next day. It doesn't work.
You're absolutely right. You build up tolerance to these drugs absolutely quickly, which is why most people, you know, might do it 2 or 3 times over the space of a year. So from that point of view, they're incredibly safe. Now, of course, if you don't plan your trip, if you're drinking, if you're taking other drugs and you're a strange place, of course, bad things can happen. But most people who use psychedelics think about this. And if other people who used other drugs took as much care as they did when they did a pill or coke or even got drunk, there'd be a lot less problems.
You can still do too much. And I had an experience where I did way too many mushrooms and I freaked out. I went to go see a movie that was 2 hours. It felt like 12 hours. And I was freaking out thinking this is never going to end. And I've got all these voices in my head. I haven't done the drug since because you can't overdo it with everything.
You're absolutely right. And about 5% of people who had taken mushrooms said that they did have a difficult or challenging experience in their lifetime. Interestingly, about half of those people said that it was a bad trip. The other half didn't. They said they kind of learned from it. But you're absolutely right. You know, people can have a lousy experience. People can occasionally think they're going to die. They've lost their mind. They lose touch with reality. And in that case, what you need is good friends around who can just walk you through it. And, you know, most people, you know, within 6 to 12 hours are pretty much back to normal. But you're right. As with any drug, you can do too much and it can cause you problems.
We're talking with Dr. Adam Winstock, who is the addiction psychologist and founder of the Global Drug Survey. I have no interest in this at all. I mean, even back in the days when I was inclined to be interested in things like this, I just never wanted to see the world distorted through external sources. I don't know if that's an articulate way of expressing it, but I, you know, yesterday as I was leaving the house, I had to run an errand at magic hour. The sunset was throwing some beautiful, soft, filtered light on some basically just weeds and a half-dead tree on a hillside. And I almost stopped to take a picture of it because it was so beautiful. It was so incredible. But to me, because that was reality, that's what made it fantastic. The idea of taking something that distorts reality in order to, I don't know,
enjoy it better.
To enjoy it better.
Yeah.
It just that, to me, there's even if it's an organic substance, there's something fake about it that doesn't attract me.
Listen, I think it's certainly not everyone's cup of tea, and I think probably about 25% of people who do a psychedelic once don't ever do it again. So I absolutely respect that, you know, some of the most beautiful things we'll experience in life, and for most people, have nothing to do with drug experiences. For some people, though, it can allow them to understand themselves and the world around them in a way that is not possible without either drugs or through meditation or in, you know, finding another way of just understanding that the world can be different. But you're absolutely right. It's not essential. There's beautiful things. I mean, particularly where you guys are, you know, you're surrounded by beauty. You don't need drugs to enjoy that. But for some people, that might enhance the beauty around them.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. And Clarence Darrow said, what kind of poem you think you're going to get out of a glass of water? So I get there are certainly a lot of artists, and you look at Peter Max and the whole psychedelic 60s. There's definitely been art that wouldn't exist in the world if it wasn't for this. But then again, you can look at paintings from the Middle Ages, which are fairly psychedelic in their own way, and you wonder how they were created. Hey, thank you for coming on and talking to us about it. It's fascinating stuff, Dr. Adam Winstock. Addiction psychologist and founder of the Global Drug Survey. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have covered a lot of stories about academia over the years. And as an enthusiastic reader myself, occasionally I will find myself trying to work my way through some published doctoral dissertation. It showed up in book form and it becomes nearly impenetrable. I remember I read a biography of Karl Marx a few years ago. And boy, oh boy, I really must have wanted to read this book to be able to get through the leaden prose. Well, there's two gentlemen who decided to expose the whole concept of peer review in academia. You know, when academic papers are written, they have to be reviewed by people with credentialed people in that area of study. And they wrote a piece to sort of show this whole gender identity, this whole sort of uber feminism that takes up and consumes so many headlines and so much space in academia today. They wrote a paper called The Conceptual Penis as a Social Construct, and they sent it for peer review to a publication called Cogent Social Sciences. Randy, you have a subscription to that, don't you?
You know, they don't have a great sports section.
That surprises me.
They don't even cover the Dodgers.
So the paper that they wrote, The Conceptual Penis as a Social Construct, included, amongst other doozies, this sentence. At best, climate change is genuinely an example of hyper-patriarchal society metaphorically manspreading into the global ecosystem. And guess what happened? Huh? The paper came back and was published without a single correction. The peers who reviewed the paper gave it the rubber stamp.
They didn't even look at it.
Joining us right now to talk about it is one of the authors of the paper. The co-author is Peter Boghossian. But with us right now is co-author James Lindsay. Mr. Lindsay, good morning, sir.
Thank you. Good morning.
I hope I presented the goal of this properly and the net result. But talk to us about your paper, The Conceptual Penis as a Social Construct, and linking apparently the male member with global warming.
Well, let me start by actually correcting you. Not that I came here to bust on you, but they did read the paper as proved by the fact that they actually had some corrections for us. They identified that we claimed to use a feminist analysis technique in our abstract that did not appear in the paper, and they recognized that fact. So they must have read the paper in order to peer reviewed it. They didn't just rubber stamp it. They read it and then rubber stamped it.
Which is maybe even more disturbing.
Yeah.
It's a little more disturbing. Absolutely. So,
now,
yeah.
What was the initial objective?
Well, the initial objective was, I don't know if you all saw, there's a lot of news a year ago or so about a paper that came out in feminist glaciology. It got a lot of grant money, and they tried to study something to do with feminist glaciers to show that there's a way to improve our science by making it a feminist science, and then to improve our relationships with ice by a feminist approach, which caught our attention. And we thought, wow, this field might be ripe for a little satire, for a hoax. And so we decided to write our own ridiculous academic paper in the field and see if we could get it published in a journal.
Now, you created Nom de, you know, tenure to do this, right? You created personas to present this
paper? Sure, yeah.
And did anybody question the validity of your backgrounds?
Well, no, I don't know necessarily that's too big of a problem. However, my background's in mathematics. One of the greatest mathematicians that ever lived, this Ramanujan guy they made a movie about recently, was just kind of a nobody from the middle of nowhere in India. And he, you know, did great work and got published. So maybe the persona part's not too terrible. But no, they didn't question that. And we did operate from, more importantly, a completely fake institution that doesn't exist. We made ourselves a fake affiliation, which would have been far easier to check than our names.
Mm. I have in front of me a piece that I just read yesterday about a researcher in culture and gender studies at Utrecht University in the Netherlands named Whitney Stark, who wrote a paper about a feminist physics. She is presented an argument for an alternative to, it's called intersectional quantum physics, to end Newton's male oppression of feminist physics.
So
this sounds like a parody also. And I guess what attracts me, besides just the good old-fashioned chain yanking that you guys are able to pull off here, is that I believe that writing and speaking is to bring clarity, and academic writing is like a sub, it's like a sub form of literature. It's like a subsect of literature where it seems to me that the purpose is to actually make clarity, is to obfuscate, not to clarify.
Yes, to make you more confused.
I think there's a saying about that. This is that people who really know what they're talking about seek clarity, and people who don't seek to hide that fact in jargon. So, then that paper, as far as I know, that you mentioned is real. This, and my background's in physics before it was in math, so I shuddered to see that. But that's sort of why we did the hoax. And this seems like it's just this big, you know, funny thing, like that the gender studies or feminist studies have gone into this, you know, self-parody, oh my gosh, they're writing this silly stuff, where they say science is sexist. But this actually goes back to a particular feminist researcher named Sandra Harding, who called Newton's famous book, Principia, a rape manual. And there is an actual political drive within some of these departments to get rid of the scientific method as sexist and replace it with a so-called feminist science that treats evidence differently, which I may mean, you know, in a way that supports whatever their political biases are.
Well, it's also significant because the concept of peer review is critical to the advancement of knowledge. And it's used in political arguments to say that, you know, fake science or science deniers don't use peer review journals, et cetera, et cetera. But what you've shown is that peer review journals are only as good as the peer review that's doing the reviewing.
Right. And so that's its own problem. Like you were saying, you know, the quality of peer review here is suspect for certain. And so that lowers public trust in what more legitimate researchers are able to produce. And that's a major crisis because we do have to advance human knowledge. We do have to get right answers to hard questions and then act accordingly if we want to do well with our problems.
Well, listen, I thank you so much for coming on. This is, you've done us a service. It's not just amusing. It's actually important to boot. So congrats and thanks again for being with us. James Lindsay and also his co-author, Peter Boghossian, who wrote The Conceptual Penis as a Social Construct. You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the Morning weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
On the next Frosty, Heidi, and Frank.
Great news. Frank is back from vacation Monday. So you won't be hearing as much of this voice.
Thank you, God.
Also, Christian Hand is in at 9 o'clock to break down music. And we've got some really cool concert tickets for you. You might win tickets to see Korn and Stone Sour or Def Leppard and Poison and Tesla. Holy it's the greatest show ever. Monday.
Frosty, Heidi, and Frank. Weekday mornings 5:30 to 9:30 on the Rock of Southern California, 95.5 KLOS.
Do you hear that racket? That is the sound of seven scientists at Exxon and Mobil thinking, working. Listen, they're discovering the precise combination of seven key ingredients in Synergy gasoline that helps you get better gas mileage. These science folks sure know how to party.
Shh.
Sorry. Synergy gasoline from Exxon and Mobil. Energy lives here.
Fuel economy claims are compared with gasoline meeting minimum government standards. Results will vary. Visit Exxon.com or Mobil.com for details.
Missing that spring in your step? Maybe it's time to stop tossing and turning on your old mattress. Time for a new bed. A Sleep Number bed adjusts to your own individualized comfort and support. And it's built to last 25 years, but costs about the same as a traditional mattress. In fact, 9 out of 10 Sleep Number owners recommend it. And you can only find it at a Sleep Number store. Oh, and right now, it's the lowest price ever on our temperature balancing i8 bed. Save $700. End Sunday. For research information and to find one of our 550 stores nationwide, go to sleepnumber.com.
Want to help the homeless in Southern California? Then join TV personality Kelly Osbourne, producer Peter Asher, and 30 of L.A.'s top musicians at the CARE Concert, Saturday, June 10th at the Palace Theater in downtown L.A. For tickets, go to WeCanCalifornia.org. We can make a difference.
R.T.C. When your drains are clogged, your sink's backed up, your toilet's on the fritz. And when you need a plumber now, just simply call Ritz. We're master plumbers, we're really nice. We're big on service, not on price.
Call Ritz Plumbing at 888-757-RITZ. They're no rooter guys here, only full-service professional plumbers. You got a kitchen or bath problem? Need an earthquake valve installed? How about a tankless water heater? Well, Ritz Plumbing specializes in trenchless sewer repair, drain cleaning and maintenance, and yes, even rooter service. Plus, 12-month interest-free financing is possible. So call Ritz Plumbing, 888-757-RITZ. Ritz Plumbing, they're the real thing, only full-service professional plumbers. And here comes the clean pipe chorus. Hit it, guys.
So when you need some plumbing in California, yay, simply call Ritz. Don't flush your money away. Ritz.
Ritz Plumbing, 888-757-RITZ.
Hey, gang, Chris Carter here to remind you to come on out to the Kobe Steakhouse in Seal Beach and experience what I've experienced, and that is their wonderful, incredible Sunday brunch, where you will enjoy bottomless mimosas, endless steak, shrimp, sushi, and so much more. It's all happening this Sunday at the Kobe Steakhouse in Seal Beach. Reservations are required. For more info, visit KobeSealBeach.com.
Go.
Hey, I'm calling about the 2007...
Right.
I saw you had a for sale sign in the window, so I assume you're down with a retro payment style. Is there a way that I could barter for the car?
Wait, you want to drive it first?
No, I mean like work it off through some sort of labor. And then you know, I could do enough labor and then that would be equal to the value of the car.
Huh.
Like an old school payment because you're selling it old school.
What other ways are there?
People are using the app LetGo.
With L-E-T Go?
It's time to snap, post, chat, and sell. It's time to let go.
America, it's time for some straight talk. You love your phone. Look at you. You hardly put it down. But you don't love that expensive wireless plan, do you? So what if I told you you can keep that phone, network, and number two for a lot less? Well, this is me telling you. It's time to switch to Straight Talk, guys. Bring your own phone and get unlimited plans starting at just $45 a month on America's largest, most dependable 4G LTE networks. Straight Talk Wireless. Only at Walmart.
Savings may vary. Please refer always to the latest terms and conditions of service at straighttalk.com.
95.5 KLOS. Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
There's been a huge drop-off of people going out to lunch in this country. I mean, really kind of an amazing drop-off. People just aren't making the time for it or spending the money on it.
I'm still one of those ladies who lunch.
But a lot of people aren't. The numbers are shocking. Wall Street Journal piece about this. And millennials in particular, they'd rather have food trucks, the gourmet food trucks, eat at their cubicles staying connected rather than being in a restaurant. But that's not the only thing that's changed in the workplace. U.S. workers, particularly millennial women, aren't taking all of their earned vacation. And this, we've talked about this before. During the recession, people who had jobs, they were afraid to take their vacation time. And Americans are famous about this. I've told this story about 800,000 times on the air over the years, but it's worth telling yet again if you've never heard it. Many, many moons ago, the Japanese government was concerned about the rise of social problems from the Japanese workers who wouldn't take any time off. Sick days, they dragged themselves in with the flu. It didn't matter. And there were divorce rate, alcoholism, all kinds of problems.
Suicide.
So they were encouraging people. They formed a government committee to encourage people to take your sick days, take some chill time. The government committee was averaging 17 hours a day. They were working 17 hours a day to tell people to chill.
To tell you to take time off.
Let's talk about this. Community expert with Glassdoor did the study, Scott Dabrowski. Scott, did I get your name correct?
You did. Thank you.
That's rare for me. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate it. So you did this survey, and it was called Project Time Off, an initiative by the U.S. Travel Association. And it was a survey of 7,331 Americans. And they found that 16.8 days per worker was up from 16.2 days the year before, but that it was the second year in a row vacation use had climbed slightly since it began tumbling around the year 2000. What happened in 2000 that we started to see people not take their days off?
In the year 2000, I'll tell you, I'm not quite sure. We did not conduct that survey, but here at Glassdoor, we conducted a similar survey about people taking their paid time off and vacation time. And what we found is that the average American is forfeiting about half of their PTO or earned vacation time, and they're leaving it on the table. So that's hard-earned dollars, vacation time that they're accruing. And so what we have found at Glassdoor is that Americans are really bad about taking vacation time off.
Now, are they doing it because they work for companies that allow them to stockpile it, to get paid in lieu of time off? Or are they doing it out of fear that if they take time off, the company may discover that they're not necessary?
So there's a little mix to both of those. So the three leading reasons why people are not taking vacation time, their PTO, is exactly what you said there, is fear. So the top reason people say they don't take their PTO is because they fear getting behind. The number two reason, they fear that no one else at their company can do the work when they're out. And another top reason, they feel that they can never be disconnected. So, yeah, there is a lot of fear, and we don't have the data that dates back to 2000 on that or even 2005 or 10. But anecdotally, this reason of fear is likely bubbling up as of late.
Boy, I tell you, the notion that there are this many people who feel that there's nobody else who can do the work is a level of hubris that I mean, unless you're Clayton Kershaw,
right? You know, somebody could probably sub for you and do all right.
You know,
yeah.
And the Dodgers made the playoffs last year without Clayton Kershaw for about 6 weeks. So
he talked about being connected too. Like you feel like you're disconnected, but everybody takes their phones with them everywhere, so they're always connected.
You're correct, and it's a blessing and a curse, kind of like Spider-Man, as they say. So, you know, being connected to work is a great thing because it does allow you to have a flexible schedule and take off at 3 o'clock and go see a child's soccer game and then, you know, log in at work and finish your work, and there's nothing wrong with that. However, it's a curse because you can take some vacation days, and, you know, the root word of vacation is actually vacate, so try and vacate the office, but with the simple swipe of a finger, you can actually be on a beach or a mountaintop and, you know, be connected to your inbox or a spreadsheet, and that is not healthy. There's actually a ripple effect of benefits that employers and employees can see if they can just literally get out of the office, free their mind of work, and they come back re-energized, more creative, more productive, and there's countless studies that show this.
We're talking with Scott Dabrowski, who's the community expert at Glassdoor, glassdoor.com. Let me, you touched on something that I have heard people tell me. It's anecdotal, but I guess if you have enough anecdotes, it becomes data. And that is that they feel that they can't catch up if they take time off. And I have had a number of friends and just acquaintances say that they don't take their vacation days because it's like they feel like they get punished for it when they come back because there's so much work waiting for them. And I've always thought, wow, you mean you would give up the experience of downtime, of traveling, of having new experiences in life just so that you can stay up to date on a day-to-day basis with, you know,
a job that really probably doesn't care about you, really?
That seems to me such a weird decision to make.
It's weird. It's scary, and it's definitely problematic. And, you know, there's other studies that show what's most important in someone's life. And people often say friends and family first. And it's not surprising to see work even amongst the top three or even in the top five, but it's often not number one. So most people are saying friends and family matter most, yet you're correct in that they're not taking time off to actually spend time with those friends and family. And let's make a really clear point here is that still most people who receive vacation time in America right now, it's often earned or accrued. So these are hard-earned dollars that they're leaving on the table. And I've never heard an employee say, I don't want more money or I don't, you know, want a pay increase, you know? And so this is dollars that you're actually earning. It's part of your total compensation package. And so it is a little insane to think that most people are not taking it all. So there are some solutions here. And, you know, it's really up to the employee, but also the employer to work on a plan before they try to vacate work. And it's very doable.
Now, what would you say? I'm going to talk theoretically here. Let's say there's an employee of a company who misses quite a bit of work because every time he gets on a plane, he gets sick. And then
somebody has to fill in for weeks at a time.
This is just theoretical, okay? There's no names involved here. I'm just saying, theoretically, there's a person who gets sick since January 1st, like, say, three or four times and misses a whole bunch of work and has sick days. You know, the company covers the sick days. But then vacation rolls around and wants to take all his vacation time, too. Now, how does that play
with holidays?
Again, so theoretically.
You know, you say theoretically, but actually it does happen. And we've heard about it happening.
Really?
So, yes. So this is a tough one.
Any names? You want to name anybody?
No, I certainly don't. But look, it does happen. There's times in all of our lives where perhaps we are sick more than we'd like. Right? That's what you're getting at. And you do have to take time off from work. And so the best thing you can do in this situation, you still have sick days, PTO, that you're accruing, is to be mindful of the busy times at work and talk to your manager about, hey, I've been out sick, which is different from PTO, but also be aware of that you are out of work for a certain time. And there do have to be sometimes some trade-offs, so you may not like it. But it's just being aware and conscious of when the busy time is at your work, how much you've been out, what your team structure is at the time, and then also putting in kind of a request that might be reasonable if you face a situation such as that.
You know, one thing you guys haven't mentioned that I kind of thought about when I first read that people weren't taking their vacation time is, you know, vacations are expensive, too. And I thought, oh, but, you know, people can still stay at home and just not go to work and take their vacation. But I think people do think, like, I'd love to go to Paris or something, but it costs too much money.
Yes, so that's actually a good thing. I think that, you know, kind of plays into the whole rise of the staycation mentality.
Yes.
And so you're right. People should be taking their days off. And even if it's staying local and, you know, treating yourself to a spa day or a nice lunch, take that time off and go for a walk or go do those things that you see all the tourists visiting your hometown and you always say, I've never done that, yet you live there. Go do something like that with your time off and just get out and use it. And if you have any reason, you know, why you're not, again, those are your hard-earned dollars, and you wouldn't leave them on the table if they were cash, most likely.
All right. Thanks so much. Appreciate you coming on with us, Scott. And again, Glassdoor.com. Most major cities, they have distinguishing characteristics. San Francisco, of course, has the hills and high rent.
And naked people.
And the fog. And, and you know, Chicago's got the big Chicago River that they dye green on St. Patrick's Day. In St. Paul, the home of Charles M. Schultz, they have bronze statues of the Peanuts characters all over the city. And in Los Angeles, we have abandoned sofas. There's nearly not a neighborhood in town that doesn't end up in the middle of the night with somebody dropping a sofa that they don't want anymore on the curb, and now it's the taxpayers' problem. and the neighbor's problem. Well, they have been immortalized and become an international sensation because a photographer named Andrew Ward has created an Instagram account called Sofas of L.A., has presented them as the street art that they are, and he's with us on the Newsmaker line right now. Good morning, Mr. Ward. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Doug. How are you?
I'm fine. I've been looking at the pictures, and some of them actually are quite attractive as street art. Not so much if it was in front of my house, but but there, God knows, this city, for some reason, outstrips any city I've ever been in for people dumping sofas on the sidewalk. And it's always sofas. It's never easy chairs.
Yeah, it's one of the things. I'm not an Angeleno native. I moved here about 20 years ago from Ireland. And I think when you have a fresher, new perspective on a city, things tend to stand out to you that may just bypass the average citizen who lives here. And this is one of the things I began to notice. And, you know, we live in this world where everybody has a phone in their pocket and on the phone is a camera. So I began to photograph them just out of people photograph their breakfast cereal or whatever they're eating, it seems. I just began photographing sofas. And after a while, I developed a collection and I thought, I'm kind of getting somewhere with this, because they kind of all started to speak to me like it was a series of mugshots of sofas, because I approach each one from the same perspective, looking at it directly, standing about 10 or 15 feet back from the curb.
Now, do you position them to frame them in an environment, or do you photograph them sort of as is?
Typically, they're photographed as is, Doug, but as you mentioned, they're kind of dropped off on the curb. So I always try to get them aligned to the front of the curb. Now, often I've got to kick them out from behind a parked vehicle. But most commonly, what you will see if you're looking at the photographs on the Instagram feed is that they're in a red zone. And you mentioned that people drop them off in the middle of the night. You know, in photographing over 1,500 sofas, I've never seen a single person kind of illegally abandon one or kind of rolled up on someone dumping one. It almost proves that there's alien life from another
exactly.
planet. Just makes these. Are the sidewalks just push up fresh crop overnight? I've never seen any human interaction with them. So that's part of my thing, that with each photograph, you will never see a human in the sofas, because that's just how I roll up on them.
Yeah, they are like lawn mushrooms. You just wake up and there they are. Or like phone books, they just appear on your doorstep. We're talking with Andrew Ward. He's the photographer. And the Instagram account you're looking for is Sofas of LA.
Fascinating. I'm looking at him now.
You can also follow him on Twitter at Eerie Andrew, E-I-R-E Andrew. And that is Ireland, of course. So I think one of the things about this city, I've been here for over 30 years now. And one of the things about the city that I think makes this more of a phenomenon is L.A. is the most, I would hazard, the most transient city in America. That people come here from all over the world, and they come to either put separation between themselves and their family or their problems, or they come to chase a dream. And some people catch the dream, or they find a plan B, but a lot of people don't, and they end up going back. And now one of the busiest, bulkiest, most difficult things to do with when you're emptying a pad is an old broken down sofa.
Yeah. How many times have you had friends who've tried to offload a pawn off a sofa on you? Hey, I got this great sofa. I think it would look great over at your place. And, you know, regrettably, that's what happens with them. It's like not all of us possess or own a pickup truck or a vehicle where you can easily move a sofa around.
Now, by the way, you're a maniac. If you own a pickup truck in the city of Los Angeles, you are an imbecile, because the only thing that pickup truck is going to get you is an endless request, series of requests from people, from alleged friends.
I need to move.
I go, could you help me
to move? Yeah.
You know, I mean, what are you, nuts?
yeah, absolutely. You know, it's true. I purchased a pickup truck about 6 years ago when we were moving house. I did the math and figured it was cheaper to buy a used pickup truck to do the move than it was to, you know, hire movers and all that. I still own the truck. It's a 1985 Toyota pickup truck. It's never going to die. And that's what I continually get. Hey, I got to move a sofa. I got to move this weekend. I'm reticent to depart from the truck, though. It's it has a special place in my heart. You know?
Well, I just, if I were you, I would just go get some fake bricks from a prop house and fill up the bed, and then you've got a good reason to get out of it. Now, one of these sofas, I'm on your, I think it's your Twitter account, which is
right.
Also the Sofas of L.A., and you have mm-hmm. this yellow and white floral pattern sofa on your cover, right mm-hmm. in the center, that is a
yep.
dead ringer for the sofa on Married with Children. It looks like the sofa that Peggy Bundy sat, parked her can on for Al Bundy. And the reason this sticks out, because I wrote an episode of Married with Children called Sofa So Good about them burning
oh, wow.
up the sofa. And it looks like a dead ringer. And at one point, they have to replace the sofa because Kelly's boyfriend set it on fire with a cigar ash.
Don't they go out into the woods?
They go out, yeah, it gets a little nutty. But they originally were just going to go out on trash night and look for another one. And there it is.
Oh, how funny.
it's just bizarre the places that these crop up. And as we're talking here, your listeners are, it's going to affect at least two dozen of them. That for the rest of their lives, they're going to begin noticing sofas on every street that they drive in. I often get texts and tweets from friends in the middle of the night saying, hey, I was driving down Van Own in the valley and I saw a sofa. I thought about you. Thanks! Exclamation mark.
Now, have you ever encountered one when you thought, you know, this really isn't that bad? I do have the 85 pickup.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I do have to confess, there's a phenomenal armchair I found in North Hollywood once, and it was before I had the 85 pickup. It got loaded back into the back of a hatchback, and it sat in my garage for years. And you know, I had to stand off with my wife. You're not bringing that into this house. And I just knew that this thing was so remarkably well built. It was about 100 years old, and so finally I did get it recovered. And that is that chair is the centerpiece of our living room. And actually, my 6-year-old son and I, we tussle every morning to see who's going to get to sit in it after we get out of bed and just kind of gather our lives before the day begins.
Well, I had a feeling that somewhere, sooner or later, you're mm-hmm. going to encounter one that was going to come home. But follow me home, Mom. Can I keep it? I promise I'll take
yeah.
it for a walk. Hey, Andrew, continued success. This is really a fun piece of local culture. The Instagram account is Sofas of LA. That's also on Twitter. Andrew Ward is the photographer. Artiste, thank you for being with us, sir. We appreciate it.
Yeah, and Doug, just in closing, there is a solution to all this. The city of Los Angeles, if you live within the city of LA, they offer a phenomenal app called MyLA311, where you can photograph and tag your bulky items for collection. It's dead simple, and with each sofa that I photograph, if it's on an LA city street, I photograph it, geotag it, and it gets collected the next week, so it's not sitting there for eternity for everybody to
nice.
See. So I encourage your listeners, if you want to know how to get rid of, the city offers that free program. So I want to be able to contribute my back to this
Well, I appreciate it, but you know, 311, that's three whole numbers people have to dial.
Yeah, but at least it's an app. When I got rid of something, I had to call, and it was like, I didn't even know you had to call to get big items picked up.
Couldn't it be 3-1? Does it have to be 3-1-1? I mean, that's a
3-1, yeah.
Yeah, I got carpal tunnel. Andrew, thank you so much. Appreciate it, sir. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.